Around the year 1655, the Arab traveler Al-Sadi wrote, "Jenne is one of the greatest Muslim markets, where traders carrying salt from the mines of Tagaza meet traders with the gold of Bitu. It is because of this blessed town, Jenne, that caravans come to Timbuktu from all points of the horizon." In the year 1985, an American volunteer walks through the same Jenne.
"Well, I came here a year ago at the height of the crisis, really. But perhaps the most striking first impression is of a beautiful and dying place. That is the one that most people get of Jenne."
Radio Netherlands, the Dutch International Service, presents We Made a Ho and Went Along, a series of 13 documentaries on the history of Africa. Episode 5, This Blessed Town, Jenne, the history of West African states and cities.
I've been here for 1 year. Almost exactly, as a matter of fact.
Matt Kovich, an American volunteer, our guide in Jenne.
"Well, as far as I know it, Jenne is a city that has an origin that's postulated for some 3 centuries before Christ. And the overpowering characteristics of its buildings is the fact that they're all made out of mud. Entirely made out of mud.
The city of Jenne, located on the Malian floodplain in between the rivers Bani and Niger, has survived the ages. There are 2 versions as to when Jenne was founded. Mr. Sanogo, the director of the Institute of Human Sciences in Mali's capital, Bamako, explains. Adama Bari is the interpreter.
"There is a version which says that people of Jenne come from Jah, the town of Jah.
Il y a une autre version qui est plus religieuse, qui est plus mythique.
Another version, another Muslim version says,
et selon laquelle des bozos seraient venus s'installer à cette place, et pour que la place soit prospère, il fallait sacrifier une fille pubère.
That the first people who settled there were bozo. They are fishermen, and when they settled, the version say that they had to sacrifice a young girl to get the prosperity of the town.
Et c'est ainsi que Tapama, qui est une bozo, a été emmurée vivante.
And this is how Tapama, who was a young girl of bozo tribe, has been sacrificed alive.
Et ça a dû être la première construction d'après la légende de Jenne.
And this was the first creation of the town of Jenne, according to the legend, the history.
We are on the floodplain of the Niger River. And the mud that they use has a very, very high clay content. It produces a very special quality of mud that holds up extremely well, is able to be sculptured, as you can see all the spires on the top of the buildings, and has been the basis for a style of architecture for basically this whole region of Mali, the fifth region.
The architecture of Jenne has become very famous and shows a remarkable consistency over a long period of time.
The overpowering characteristic is, although that it's in the middle of 2 rivers, the climate is very, very dry, which actually serves to preserve the buildings of the city more than they would probably be otherwise preserved in a more humid climate. So you get buildings here that, even though they're crumbling, can even be up to 100 to 150 years old. At least that's what I'm told.
Otto Verkoren, senior lecturer in urban geography at Utrecht University in the Netherlands, studied Jenne.
The number of houses which was counted by 19th century discoverers like Cayet and Dubois and Lieutenant de la Force, the number of houses is declining very rapidly. Houses are crumbling down, and well, there is no doubt that the cultural heritage of Djenné as an important asset of Malian history is declining in an incredibly rapid rate.
Well, shall I start? As you can see, a lot of these houses are in very, very bad repair right now. And the reason was that was in last year, we basically had no rainy season. So we were basically unable to do the, what they call in French, le crépissage, which is the yearly covering of the walls with mud that keeps the houses sustained.
We strongly feel that Djenné belongs to a group of cities who was once important and who, due to a number of factors, have lost importance. You see the same thing in Mali for cities like Dia Farabe. You see comparative things in Niger. You see comparative things in Senegal. A number of cities once important apparently lost their grip on the commercial and transport structure, and they went down.
As you can see out ahead of us is the big floodplain. This area is once all covered with water, this entire flat part. So a city that had once been entirely surrounded by water, accessible by boat, probably quite lovely by the approach also, is now a place that's surrounded by a virtual desert.
In the scorching heat of a virtual desert, it looks as if Djenné is dreaming of its glorious past as a vital trading center. The history of Djenné is very much linked to the history of the West African states like the ancient kingdoms of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. To discover when the West African states were formed, we will have to go back many centuries before Christ. We talked about it with Professor Edu Bohen, retired professor of Ghana University in Legon. We meet him at home in his study, really the setting for a scholar. So we asked Edu Bohen to describe his workplace to start with.
Oh my goodness. This study is I think, a unique place. My wife thinks that it is in a state of absolute mess and should be cleaned up. But I've resisted this because when I close the door, I'm cut off completely, both from the house and from the outside world. And that is where I do all my work.
And it is in this inspiring environment that Professor Edu Bohen explains the general outlines of West African state formation. It is, he says, the result of both external and internal factors which were prevalent at the time the West African states were formed.
The external factors being the motivation provided by external intruders, external traders, external invaders, and the internal factors being the environmental conditions, the economic conditions, and in particular, the leadership provided by the particular royal family or family that spearheaded the evolution of the particular state.
And Edu Bohen stresses the importance of the already mentioned internal factors if you want to really comprehend how West African states were formed.
Because, you know, until very, very recently, their approach to African history has been very, very external. They are looking at Africa through the European spectacles, and they are interpreting African events and African developments in terms of what was happening in Europe. And they're also denying that Africans had any initiatives. And so they have neglected the internal factors and the internal dynamics that brought about these changes that took place. And it's about time that this balance was redressed. And that's what we've been trying to do all these years.
One of the many African scholars who has been busy in redressing the balance, as Professor Edu Boahen puts it, is Pone Thorne, Nigerian student in history. He studied the Ngoni people living in the bend of the River Niger.
Well, the historians have not... they seem to have neglected that the Ogoni could contribute to the history of West Africa. So when I started to study African history, I decided that if I could bring out the history of the Ogoni, it could be a contribution to the whole history of West Africa. Based on the history of the Ogoni, as I have found out in my field work, their major interest was agriculture. In fact, agriculture was the thing they had as the principal walk of life, so that they encouraged agriculture in the sense that the best farmers were given titles. So that was a way they encouraged agriculture. And if you hold a title as a farmer, as a yam title, this is called yam title, now you could be a chief. You could be a ruler. You come into the class of rulers. If you hold a title of as a yam chief, you come into the class of rulers. So the idea of state being imported from either from the Arabs or from the Europeans to Africa has no proof.
And Kpone Thorne finds a supporter for his view that it would be wrong to say both the Arabs, who came on the scene around 800 AD, and the Europeans, who appeared much later in the 16th and 17th century, were jointly responsible for the creation of African states. Professor Edu Boahen has a very definite opinion.
This is complete and utter nonsense. You need the personal factor, the personal touch, the leadership, the inspiration, you know, which has to be provided by a specific person or a specific family. And it's usually this family or this specific person that forms or constitutes the royal family of that particular state or kingdom or ultimately the empire.
Mali, for example, founded by the legendary Sundiata around 1200 AD. But then we're talking about an advanced stage in the formation of West African states. This can't be explained without looking at the external factors which play a decisive role.
The main important thing, of course, was the presence of the Europeans on the West African coast. As far as the four states, like Asante, Benin, Yoruba, or if I had to put it in the proper historical order, Benin, Yoruba, and Asante were concerned. And as far as the ancient empires of Ghana, Mali, and Sege were concerned, there were also important external factors. And this was, of course, the coming of Islam. And with it, the coming of Muslim clerics and Muslim traders, who again provided the motivation. You know, trade routes emerged as a result of their presence, and the desire to control those trade routes, and the desire to motivate, maximize the profits of the slave trade, were some of the basic factors underlying the expansion of these states.
A Sunday evening in Jene.
As you see, people are starting to filter in for the market day. Probably one of the most ethnically diverse markets in the entire country. It's a fascinating place.
According to Arab sources, Jene was founded in the middle of the 8th century. the Nono of the Soninke group, superimposed themselves upon the Bozo fishermen in the region of Djene. They intermingled with the Bozo and developed Djene into a center of trade. It appears that Islam was well established through trading contacts before this religion was adopted by the ruler of Djene. The conversion of Djene took place about 1200 AD under the Sultan Kunburu. After the king had joined Islam, he demolished his palace and replaced it with a mosque dedicated to the service of God Almighty.
Here's the mosque. The mosque is the largest all-Banco structure in the world. This type of mud Banco architecture is not to be found anywhere else. This is the oldest Cartier of Djene. It's called Yobu Kaina. It's a Sonrai word. Yobu means market. Kaina means small. Small market. Hey, I carni halamawa.
Walking through Djene is walking through history, the history of a town that has survived many, many centuries. It has witnessed the rise and fall of the Empire of Mali, remained independent for quite a long time before being incorporated in the Empire of Songhai in the 16th century.
This being a commercial outpost of the Sonrai Empire in Gao. The floodplain becomes an excellent grassland for the animals after the waters have receded.
Djene was one of the important trading centers of that empire. And it was one of the most southern points of that empire. And that point served more or less as the entry pool of the trade, starting from the Barbary States, from the Mediterranean coast, from North Africa, across the Sahara, into the Western Sudan. That's one part. And then from the Western Sudan into the southern savanna areas and into the forest regions of West Africa. So it was a real, more or less, the cultural crossroads and also the commercial crossroads, a very important entrepot, not a terminal of the trade coming from the north, but in fact, one of the important points where the button, as it were, of the transcontinental trade routes linking North and Western Africa, where the button was also where changed between the traders coming from the north and the traders coming from the forest and the coastal regions of West Africa. So it's a very important area indeed.
It is absolutely unbearably hot here during the hot season.
Deteriorating walls in a declining city.
Hey,
a city which for centuries had been the center of wealth and prosperity.
Yes, for a long time at least, but from about the midst of the 16th century onwards, trading routes were moving to the eastern part of the Saharan Africa, moving to Libya and Egypt, which meant that the importance of the Western African trading routes declined, and with it, the importance of Trans-Sahara trade declined. However, Djene could live up to these problems through a function of the stocking of the city of Timbuktu. But the Trans-Sahara trade was almost over by the end of the 17th, by the beginning of the 17th century. Probably a number of traders left Djene and they settled in the city of Ségou or in the city of Timbuktu.
Right now we're encroaching on one of the newer Cartiers by the name of Kanafa. At the end of this road, you can see a few buildings. Among them is the dispensaire and the infirmary. Dispensary and infirmary, as it were. These buildings were made out of cement at the behest of the French that were here and are really quite an abomination to the Djene styling. But that's a classic example of what the colonists did. They basically took no regard for the traditional architecture styles here at all. They simply came in and built the buildings that they needed in their styles, regardless of what kind of havoc that played with the continuity of the city.
For as far as we know, from the decline of the Trans-Sahara trade, there was a gradual decline in the flourishing, although there are no reasons to suppose that Djenneh became a poor city, not as poor as it became by the end of the 19th century, at least. The first very probably has been the fact that the city was incorporated in a newly and quite sternly Islamic empire, the one of Sheikhu Amadu, which caused a lot of strife and problems and probably caused a tremendous loss of traders from the city. But the most important reasons are closely related to the arrival of the French, who incorporated Mali as part of the French Saharan Empire and who caused an enormous shifting in trading routes over land. Caravans were no longer important. Slavery, who, as a matter of fact, was the engine of the caravans. Trading was highly labor-intensive, and it could only be done through slaves. The abolishment of slavery caused a complete collapse of traditional trading forms, instead of which the French worked with steamboats on the Niger and overland transport. For both types of transport, Djenneh was not fit.
As you can see, we're dominated by motor vehicles now. As you can see, in the older part of the city, the roads were not made for motor vehicles at all. Very thin little streets, basically made just for walking, perhaps for a horseback ride very periodically. As you can see, there's a motorcycle here in front of us of a rather new make and model. So you can see that as the modern world encroaches, young people don't want to stay in this city. And the sources of money are going to center around those places that are more accessible by car and by plane, neither of which Djenneh is accessible by nearly at all. Now Djenneh survives really mainly as a small regional commerce center, as a circle in the region of Mopti, a very large percentage of its money coming from tourists who are coming to see the city because it's so ancient.
Yes, I think there are several elements important. One, it still is a very important religious center. There is a great number of Quran schools, and they are very famous. And there must be still a great number of original antique manuscripts written in Arabic, dealing with the local history, or in which the oral history has been written down. Probably many of them are not known, and probably many of them even are not seen at all. A third function, which is still important and which gives Djenneh a completely different image, is the Monday market, when thousands of people from the surroundings come and do their shopping.
Well, this is Djenneh on Monday morning. This is our weekly market. Markets take place once a week in each city in the area. The major ones being Djenneh, Sofara, Kwakuru, Mopti, and San. As you can see, it's 10 o'clock in the morning and the market is already full. People begin coming on Sunday night, filling this marketplace right here in front of the Grand Mosque. It's a very ethnically diverse market. The Bozo people come from the river country to sell their wares, predominantly fish. You have Dogon people coming from the mountainous country, bringing down various handicrafts that they've made. Oftentimes you even have tomsheks coming from the upper northern part of the country, bringing down leather goods and various handicrafts that they make, including swords, blankets, pillows, the whole gauntlet of things. You always have to do your best to barter as hard as possible to get the lowest price. As you can see in front of us, and you can hear in the background, furious bargaining activity is going on right now. Okay, right now they're in the middle of bargaining, of bartering. The discussion is becoming a little bit hot. One is claiming that the price is just. The guy who would like to buy it is saying that he knows with the changeover to the franc CFA that times have become very difficult and he can't buy it. He says al-baraka, which is a Islamic word which means pray to God, but it's a way of saying please lower the price.
Al-baraka. Al-baraka, al-baraka. Al-baraka.
Jenny is, above all, a very, very Islamic city. Very, very strict. And very, very conservative. And that is another reason why you can see this conflict between the modern world as it encroaches and the conservative Jenne Islamic community as it tries to sustain itself. It's not uncommon to see a young man completely dressed in Western garb, jeans, sports shirt, nice shoes, next to an old man wearing the traditional Islamic robes. It strikes you in the face basically at all moments. I'm not sure if it's a question of which of those influences will win or lose, but it's more of a question is how are they going to find a happy medium to maintain what has made Jenne a beautiful city and incorporate all the influences that are playing upon it at the time.
من يشاء ويهدي من يشاء ويهدي من يشاء وما يعلم جنود ربك إلا هو وما هي إلا ذكر للبشر كلا.
Okay, today we are in Jenne and it is Monday morning. The Marabu Modi is teaching his student, Muslim student, to learn Arabic. The students are repeating after him, and if the students make mistakes of pronunciation, he corrects them. And if there is someone who doesn't understand or who can't read well, he comes closer to him and shows his slate. Then he makes him repeat. This is how he teaches his students.
A Quran school on a Monday morning in Jenne. Shrill voices of children, the stern bass of the marabu. A blind boy in his 20s, dressed in a soft glazed light blue bubu, decorated with white broidery, towers high above the little ones. Despite the lips moving, his voice is drowned among the novices' deafening bubble. But if you go close enough, you can detect the melodious sounds of God's word, recited by this blind messenger who knows the Quran by heart. The hollow sockets which take the place of his absent eyes are filled with a useless, trickly tear fluid which almost imperceptibly vibrates to the quiver of his vocal cords. Sadness shimmers on these tiny lakes, but his face shows no sign of this emotion whatsoever. On the contrary, it seems filled by an aura of august acquiescence.
You've been listening to This Blessed Town, Jenne, the fifth in a series of 13 documentaries on the history of Africa. The programs are written, compiled, and produced by Peter van den Akker. Stanley Nyawa is the narrator. sound engineers René Adama and Ruud van Steenis. This is a Radio Netherlands production.